every year, the third weekend in October, and Dina always had a representative sitting on our government listening panel. So they
Naima,
were in the
we're
going
to have to leave it there as the show wraps up, but we're going to continue to follow this issue. Naima Mohammed, organizing co-director for the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, and Will Hendrick, attorney with Waterkeeper Alliance and manager of the organization's North Carolina Pure Farms, Pure Waters campaign. That does it for the show. I'll be speaking tonight in Tampa, 7:30 at the Seminole Heights United Methodist Church, Thursday in Atlanta, 7 p.m. at the First Iconium Baptist Church, Friday at 2 at Carlton College in Minnesota, 6:30 at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. On Saturday, we're in Madison. At night, we're in Chicago. On Sunday, we're in three cities in Michigan. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is just about, look at that, the seconds are going right there to 5 o'clock p.m. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of WagonCon 2017. WagonCon takes place May 5th, 6th, and 7th at the Dallas Civic Auditorium. WagonCon features 2.5 days of role-playing games, board games, miniature war games, and collectible card games. There will be special guests, workshops, demos, and more. Again, that's WagonCon 2017. WagonCon takes place May 5th, 6th, and 7th at the Dalles Civic Auditorium at the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, 323 East 4th Street in the Dalles. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We have this monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. We call it KBOO at the Clinton. This month's film is Plant This Movie. It screens on Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. Plant This Movie explores the zeitgeist of urban farming from around the world, from Havana to Shanghai, from New Orleans to Portland, Oregon. The filmmaker will be present. Again, that's Plant This, Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. This is also brought to you by Portland 5, presenting the Django Festival All-Stars on Thursday, June 15th at the Wingstad Theater. This group of hot jazz swing musicians from Europe carry on the legacy of guitarist Django Reinhardt. Tickets for this all-age event on June 15th with Django Festival All-Stars are available now at portland5.com. And now, your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, KBOO spoke with Margot Black of Portland Tenants United, who will debate PSU economics professor Gerald Mildner on the merits of rent control at the Alberta Rose Theater tonight at 7 p.m.
The tiny house bill passed the legislature by a vote of 43-16 and now moves to the Senate for consideration.
And according to a new report from the National Resources Defense Council, nearly 20% of Americans are drinking from one of the 180,000 water systems that reported violations of the Safe Water Drinking Act.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. There are a few more important issues in Portland today than tenants' rights. At 7 p.m. this evening, Margot Black of Portland Tenants United will debate PSU economics professor Gerald Mildner on the merits of rent control at the Alberta Rose Theater. The doors will open at 6:30. KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Ms. Black earlier today and filed this report.
Yesterday at your talk at the Eastside Democratic Club, I think you mentioned that the idea of land ownership is very old. It got me thinking, mm-hmm. Even animals have territory, and probably mm-hmm. with humans, agriculture was probably a turning point. Any other main mm-hmm. events in this evolution of this idea?
I do think, agriculture is certainly when the idea of borders got more codified. Certainly in American history, only white men could own land initially, and that's even more true in Oregon, where we went to the trouble of writing that into our constitution, one of the only states to enter the union with a law against people of color not just not owning land but even being able to live or work here. And so when you think about what the benefits of land ownership are, generationally, the folks who are homeowners today, many of whom claim, luck and not hard work, which is nice of them to recognize that it's sort of privilege-based, whatever they inherited from their parents or whatever help they got from their parents with their down payment is because their parents were able to own a home, which is almost certainly because their parents were. And so when you look at the winners and losers, it's not a surprise that the majority of the white middle class are homeowners and the majority of, marginalized communities aren't, because, white men got a very, 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 very long head start on this.
Indeed, we did. And where we are today is high vacancy rates in high-end apartments and people living on the street.
Correct. It's weird. I mean, it's not natural. It's not Econ 101. It's not like this, preordained way it has to be until the invisible hand, moves things into the right place. I mean, it's scarcity by design. Venture capital flowing into urban centers and trying to get them all ready for a wealthy elite to move into them, and with just utter disregard for the social costs that it has on the day-to-day working class folks who keep the city ticking, and they just kind of act like that's not their problem, and somehow it'll just sort of shift out in some way.
I think you mentioned also yesterday at the Eastside Democratic Club that money is basically being pumped out of the city.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the average rent increase and just the rent increase, not even the rent, but just the amount that it's gone up, Don McIntosh from Northwest Labor Press did a calculation based on, the average number of renters and the average rent increase, and calculated that $600 million has been transferred from renters' pockets to landlords just in rent increases. Think about where that money could be going. I mean, that could be going to our local economy. It could be going toward, parents being able to spend more time with their children or provide better living environments and experiences for their children. It could be going towards savings. It could be going toward not living in poverty. And so what are the externalities borne by the overall taxpayer for that wealth transfer? What are the externalities borne by the education system, by the transiency of our children, and the impact that has on an entire classroom, on our health system, that is overburdened by not being able to serve communities who are both too transient in order to have permanent health care providers, and who also are made sick by their housing that they can't enforce their habitability rights for because they are too terrified of a rent increase or a no-cause eviction, or because it's unpermitted because they can't afford, a permitted market rate house.
And these are costs that society as a whole bear.
Yes. Yes. And we bear it as taxpayers, and we bear it as, worried citizens who are seeing tent cities spring up on our sidewalks. And we bear it as, parents in the classroom, wondering how, our children are able to get a decent education with a number of children constantly being moved in and out of the classrooms.
So to push back, I understand you founded with your husband PTU. What's in a name?
Mm-hmm. what's in a name? So Portland Tenants United is a tenants union for Portland metro area tenants that is committed to being, you know, independent, unapologetically aggressive agents for change, using a labor organizing model to build tenant power to change the conditions of our living environment, whether that means changing laws or using direct action to challenge our landlords on oppressive housing policies. But we are fighting for the rights of existing tenants to be able to stay in their homes and their communities, but with, you know, an eye toward making sure that those communities are also open to newcomers, so that somebody who moves here and is now an existing tenant also has a right to stay and live in their communities. But we really do feel like the folks who are here and who helped create the value in their communities, who, you know, by participating and investing in their communities have increased those land values, who've made our cities great places to be, you know, that is unearned wealth on the part of the landowner who is now cashing in on that. And we feel like as a society has created that value, society has the right to regulate and tax that value and protect the citizens in the, or the residents in those communities who helped create it from displacement and price gouging.
Great. Can you say a few words about how Portland Tenants United is organized?
We're using a labor union model right now. We have, you know, a steering committee, which we call the organizing committee, and it's kind of the mothership. And we have a number of working groups, and we have dues-paying members. We're actually having a membership meeting this Sunday from 3 to 6 p.m. at SEIU 503 on Foster and 64th. We're really eager to take the next step toward being a truly democratic, member-driven organization.
We have state laws against rent control. How did that happen, and what are you going to do about it?
In the late 70s, there was some tenant organizing, mainly among mobile home park owners who rent the land that they that their homes live on, but they own the structures. And those land rents were being increased at a rate that was unsustainable for them. And so they had a pretty successful, they did some pretty successful organizing. And there were two local, some version of rent control. I don't know explicitly what policy was on the ballot. They were narrowly defeated. And then the big real estate, if you will, the home builders, the realtors, the landlord lobby, came to the legislature and said, boy, that was sure a close call. If we could just go ahead and prevent the people from democratically changing their living conditions, that would be just great. Can we ban rent control statewide and make it impossible for local jurisdictions to have their own rent control ordinances? That'd be wonderful. It was a temporary ban for 2 years, and then it became a permanent ban in 1985. Our former mayor, Charlie Hales, who was at the time a lobbyist for the mobile home park owners, like the land owners, testified about the dangers and terror of rent control. And somehow our legislature ignored you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters. I've seen them down at the archives, you know, just stacks and stacks and stacks of letters from mostly senior citizens who were living in those mobile home parks, who were grappling with $16 rent increases, which in today's dollars are $50 rent increases. If that tells you how profound just $16 were on our fixed income seniors back then, now we're dealing with $500 rent increases, now 10 times bigger than those rent increases in today's dollars. And our legislature thought that, the most important thing was maintaining the right to price gouge and displace and not protecting seniors in their homes.
Hales can be effective, no doubt. Is today's Portland City Council an ally?
Yeah, I mean, I think that right now it's really important to be doing education about rent control. Ted Wheeler has said on numerous occasions he's against rent control, but he does think there should be limits on how often rents can be raised and by how much they can be raised, which is rent control. So, I think when it comes down to saying, you know, should a 100% rent increase be legal? Should a 50% rent increase be legal? I think our city council is pretty aligned in saying that those should be regulated, but they're not ready to say they want to lift the ban on rent control because they don't really see that those two things are the same thing. We obviously have a very, very, very strong champion in Chloe Udaly, who is elected on a renter's rights mandate. So I'm optimistic that we'll get an ordinance, but I know that it'll be a really hard fought battle.
I think Sammy Black is quoted as calling you the poster child for someone who should be a homeless drug addict. You care to say a few words?
Well, I think that's because it's, you know, I spent a good part of my childhood, early childhood, in foster care. My mother is profoundly psychotic. She's been institutionalized or incarcerated most of my life, including now. I don't know my biological father. I was raised by my grandmother, who was a wonderful person, really the best person on the planet, I think. She passed away when I was 19, which was just a couple, I think 6 weeks after my daughter was born. So I had a daughter at 19 as well, and promptly after my grandmother died, and then I became a single mom, my partner and I split up. I got a no cause eviction from my apartment in Southwest Portland, and I had to move out to Hillsboro because it was the only place I could qualify for on my own and afford. I lost my job because I couldn't get to work on time without a car. You know, now I was working in Hillsboro, and I really, like, I think back on those times and I see myself, you know, going down the drain. I don't know about being a homeless drug addict, and I also don't want to disparage people who self-medicate with drugs or who live outside. But I certainly was living very, very, very precariously. And if it hadn't have been for the charity of a family friend who let me live with him for 4 years rent-free, which allowed me to care and parent my daughter and go to college and really right my ship, I certainly wouldn't be where I am now. And I think that shows the transformative nature of stable housing. And what he did for me is what a lot of middle-class parents can do for their kids, but so many of us don't have those middle-class parents who can offer that. And so for those folks who are spiraling down the drain, I think it's really notable that my spiral started with a no-cause eviction. I was holding on with white knuckles despite losing my caretaker and my partner and being a single mom with no support. But that no cause eviction just kind of flung me into a whole new area where the white knuckles be damned. I was going down the drain, but stable housing was the game changer for me. And I just think, wow, what if everybody who was, you know, living precariously in the margins of poverty had 4 or 5 years to like get their life together and you know, didn't have to worry every single day whether or not the bills were going to get paid. You know, the biggest, most non-negotiable one being the rent.
It seems like nationwide, yeah, there's a movement to get math and science back in politics. Are you ready to run for commissioner?
I'm ready to be convinced to run for commissioner. I don't have designs on holding political office. I really want to be where I'm most effective. I don't know where that is right now. I do feel like my analytical mindset is a virtue in this work, and I wish there was more of it. But, you know, I worry a lot about all the compromises that I hear, you know, have to happen in the halls of power. I worry a lot about, you know, kind of drinking the Kool-Aid of the establishment. I worry a lot about trying to change the system from within and whether or not that is actually the way to do it. So I'm willing to be convinced, but it is not like my lifelong dream.
Any final thoughts for our listeners? Maybe some good news?
House Bill 2004, which would end no-cause evictions and lift the ban on rent control. House Bill 2004 is our bill, and it needs to get through the Senate so the governor can sign it. And it needs to get through it as the strongest bill possible, and it's not going to happen without phone calls and letters, incessant phone calls and letters to the Senate.
Margo Black, thanks so much for talking to KBOO today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Margot Black of Portland Tenants United. She'll be debating the merits of rent control this evening at the Alberta Rose Theater at 7 o'clock, doors at 6:30. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Despite the pressing need for affordable housing in Oregon, a, quote, tiny bill house may still face a stiff test in the state Senate. House Bill 2737 would require the state to adopt a separate set of building codes for prefab or site-built homes that measure less than 400 square feet. Yesterday, the bill passed the legislature by a vote of 43-16 and now moves to the Senate for consideration. The new regulations are intended to simplify the requirements for tiny homes, which many believe are a key element to finding a solution for the state's low-income and homeless populations. Sponsors in the legislature also promote the simplified building codes as a benefit to companies that manufacture or build the small housing units. Opponents raised concerns that the revised codes may reduce fire safety standards, and officials have expressed concern that the state may be at legal risk if the fire safety of the tiny homes is not up to standards.
Michael Stoops, a prominent homeless advocate both locally and nationally for over three decades, died on May 1st. Stoops was previously director of community organizing for the National Coalition for the Homeless. Before that, he led the Burnside Community Council, which ran a variety of homeless services, including Bologna Joe's on East Burnside. In 1987, Stoops organized support for congressional legislation that brought billions to the homeless in the following decades. That same year, his sexual activities with homeless underage boys became public, leading to his resignation from the Burnside Community Council. Moving from Indiana to Portland in 1976 at the request of his Mennonite church, Stoops first worked as a counselor for Vietnam War veterans. Soon becoming interested in issues of homelessness, he moved into the Butte Hotel in Old Town Chinatown and did not leave until he left Portland about a decade later.
Sean King, Black Lives Matter activist and columnist for the New York Daily News, will speak tomorrow at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The event is titled The New Civil Rights and Global Justice. Last year, King launched a project called the Injustice Boycott. The boycott aims to pressure cities that ignore or participate in police brutality. Standing Rock, San Francisco, and New York City were the first three cities targeted by the boycott. King threatened to add Portland to that list in response to the Portland police contract, which lets officers view body camera footage of non-fatal conflicts before they file incident reports. Now, King is a featured speaker for the World Affairs Council of Oregon. He will speak from 7 to 8:30 on the modern struggle for civil rights.
While the high number of strip clubs in Portland is often cited, the Umatilla City Council went one better. Last night, the council appointed Darren Duforth, owner of a local strip club, as the city's new mayor. The previous mayor, David Trott, resigned in March because of irreconcilable differences with the council. The council will next appoint two new members, replacing one councilor who resigned last month for health reasons and another who resigned at last night's meeting. With a population just over 7,000, Umatilla is 180 miles east of Portland, where the Umatilla River joins the Columbia.
The gun holder who pointed a Glock at Don't Shoot PDX and Black Lives Matter protesters last summer was sentenced to 40 days in jail and banishment from owning guns for at least 4 years. Michael Aaron Strickland was caught on video wielding the gun. His lawyer claimed in court that his finger was not on the trigger, but the judge considered the fear the gun instilled in the protesters. The judge deemed pulling out the gun inappropriate since it was not in self-defense.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants everyone to keep exercising their rights.
If we too quickly tire of protesting, of marching, we may soon not be able to get out the door or have a door to get out of. The rich can be patient. They won't miss a meal or be evicted next month. Many of the rest of us are discovering what we thought was solid ground we were standing on is foundation by a net that the Republican acid rain, slowly increasing since Reagan, has been dissolving one droplet at a time. You only notice when someone close to you falls through, when you reach for a handhold that suddenly comes loose, and you almost lose your balance and tumble into the slow, murky whirlpool of government assistance and punishment. Our world is so riddled with holes it could fall on its own, but with all those greedy militant sledgehammers waiting to lash out, we won't have to wait that long. But let's not surrender in advance. We need to stand out while it's still safe. No one, not Trump, the police, the army, can stop the sun from rising. No one will stop me from helping a fallen comrade. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Kitchen Table Conversations at 6. At 7, it's Keeping It Real. Tomorrow's weather for the KBOO listening area is mostly sunny with a high of 82 and showers expected in the evening. Today in history, in 1932, the hardest working man in show business, James Brown, was born. He died on Christmas Day, 2006. Today's quote also comes from James Brown. Sometimes you struggle so hard to feed your family one way, you forget to feed them the other way. With spiritual nourishment, everybody needs that.
Calling Barack Obama's use of the 1906 Antiquities Act an egregious use of power. Last week, Donald Trump signed an executive order to allow national monument designations to be rescinded or to be scaled back. The move was part of the administration's drive to open up more federal land to drilling, mining, and other extraction development. Conservationists are anticipating legal challenges to the order because no president has ever rescinded the designation of a national monument. The Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in southern Oregon is one of the areas that could be targeted for review. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has this report.
President Trump's executive order asking the Department of the Interior to review national monuments could put the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in southern Oregon in the administration's sights. Yesterday at the Capitol, the House Natural Resources Committee held a meeting on the Antiquities Act, used to designate Cascade Siskiyou as a national monument. Panel members at the meeting, as well as the president, say designations have been made without local support. However, Pam Marsh, Oregon State Representative and business owner within the monument, says that was not the case with Cascade Siskiyou.
Our local elected officials in Ashland have supported expansion. Local electeds and talent did the same. So we believe that monument designation is really in the interest of our neighborhood and our region.
President Obama expanded Cascade Siskiyou in January from 65,000 to 113,000 acres. Trump's order applies to monuments that cover more than 100,000 acres of land and have been designated or expanded since 1996. Jack Williams, senior scientist at Trout Unlimited, agrees there was local support to expand the monument and says the decision was made in part to include the rest of a watershed left out in its creation. The monument is recognized as one of the most biologically diverse regions in the country. Williams says the expansion allows for better protection of the area.
And under management as a national monument, it just gives a higher priority to the watershed, gives a higher priority to road management, and I think that sort of thing will benefit the native species up there.
Marsh says the expansion has been a boon for the local recreational economy, but she worries timber interests could creep in if the monument is reviewed. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke has said the administration wants to manage these monuments with a focus on traditional multiple use. Marsh says the land would be better left untouched.
When we move forward into future decades, we will not regret the trees we didn't cut or the ore we didn't mine. What we will treasure is the wild spaces that we protected, and that'll remain a long-term asset to us.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And now here's Anthony Lieserwitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lieserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Traverse City, Michigan may be small, but it has set a big goal: to power all city operations with 100% clean energy within 4 years.
That includes city buildings, streetlights, the wastewater treatment plant. All the operations of the city will be powered by renewable energy.
That's Kate Madigan of the Michigan Climate Action Network. The organization joined other groups and citizens to demand action by their local officials. They persuaded the city commission to adopt the 100% goal. That put Traverse City alongside nearly 20 other leading U.S. cities, large and small, all with the same goal of 100% clean energy. Achieving the goal will require improving energy efficiency, which will reduce air pollution and save money that the city government can use for other important needs. Since the resolution passed, Madigan says she's heard from other cities looking to follow their lead.
No, if we can do it in Traverse City, anybody can do it. Every community can do this. So that it really makes me feel hopeful that it will be contagious and that more and more communities will continue to commit to 100% renewable energy.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Portlanders and others with good water supplies should be thankful. According to a new report from the National Resources Defense Council, nearly 20% of Americans are currently drinking from one of the 180,000 water systems that are reported to be in violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act. Many of the violations were health-based, meaning that they involved a specific danger to human health rather than a simple violation of federal reporting or monitoring requirements. Most of these health-based violations were due to chemical byproducts of disinfection treatments that are linked to cancer or to properly remove dangerous pathogens from surface and groundwater. As drinking water safety continues to decline, Trump's proposed budget makes deep cuts to clean energy programs and public health agencies, including a 31% cut to the EPA.
Throughout the presidential campaign, Donald Trump promised to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords that were signed by nearly 200 countries in late 2015. And at last Saturday's rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump referred to the International Climate Agreement as, quote, a broken system of global plunder at America's expense, and promised a big decision on the accords within the next few weeks. But despite packing his cabinet and senior staff with climate deniers, the Trump administration is apparently divided over whether or not to withdraw. Steve Bannon and EPA Director Scott Pruitt have come down firmly in favor of withdrawal. But former Exxon CEO and current Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, as well as first daughter Ivanka and son-in-law slash advisor Jared Kushner, have urged the president to remain in the agreement and set reduced goals and objectives. Susan Binias, the former State Department lead climate lawyer, has said that the agreement allows for countries to adjust their commitments either up or down, but White House lawyers question the legitimacy of this claim. Other nations, including Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom, have urged the U.S. to remain at the Paris table. Many have also stated that they remain fully committed to the accords, regardless of the path the U.S. takes. The Sierra Club has questioned whether Trump has the legal authority to rewrite the current climate regulations and has promised to sue if the administration attempts to alter or withdraw from the treaty.
The bipartisan budget agreement that prevented a government shutdown also included $120 million in additional funding to cover the growing cost of protecting the Trumps. $60 million will be used to supplement Secret Service funds and provide enhanced security measures at Trump Tower in New York. A portion of the money would also be used to cover the increased costs of providing Secret Service protection for Trump's adult children as they do business around the world. Another $60 million will be set aside to reimburse cities whose security costs have skyrocketed as a result of visits by Trump or his family. Cities likely to receive reimbursement include New York, the current home of Trump's wife Melania and son Barron, and Palm Beach County, Florida, the home of Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. According to the New York City Police Commissioner, the city has spent an extra $300,000 per day providing protection at Trump Tower between Election Day and the inauguration, and about $125,000 per day since then. Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York thanked New York's congressional delegation for help in securing the funding and said, "We are getting what we are owed." The additional funding will be used between now and the end of the federal government's fiscal year, which is September 30th. Many are questioning the cost of protecting the lavish lifestyle of the Trump family. His Mar-a-Lago trips have cost an estimated $21.6 million so far this year. The total cost of protecting the Obamas over the first 8 years over their 8 years in the White House was $97 million. Vanity Fair magazine has estimated that providing security during Trump's presidency, even a single term, could cost $1 billion.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We are in mediation, and the main sticking point is our members' health care.
Roy Morrison, organizer for the Teamsters-affiliated Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Railroad Union. Rail workers are out at several major U.S. terminals rallying for a fair labor contract. Morrison says that the health care concessions the railroads want aren't economically necessary or fair. The Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Union is urging the 13 different U.S. rail unions to present a united front at the bargaining table. Morrison would like to see this day of action around the health care concessions issue unite all of the rail unions when it comes to collective bargaining.
Our union is working really hard to build relationships with other rail unions in our craft. We all kind of negotiate separately, but when it comes to healthcare, we're all part of the same healthcare group, so it applies to all of us. We're really reaching out to those other rail unions to try and get their membership to stand united and firm on our healthcare and say enough's enough. Our guys are paying enough. The economic necessity just isn't there. I'm pretty excited about it, and I hope it creates a change in our industry where our unions are working together.
RWDSU says workers at Bloomingdale's have ratified their first ever union contract that recognizes workers struggling with diminished wages from online sales. RWDSU President Stuart Applebaum.
This contract was important because it recognizes for the first time that workers are struggling with diminished wages from online sales, and it does something about it.
Bloomingdale's workers were spending time and effort in the store only to see the customer go home and order online. Applebaum says his members were losing out under that commission model, and this contract takes a first important step toward addressing the issue.
What it provides is that workers are not going to be expected to fulfill e-commerce orders instead of trying to earn commissions themselves. That's important. The contract also wipes out their deficits from the draw versus commission system. It provides wage increases as well for those who are not solely on commission. It provides greater health care options, and the company absorbs more of the cost of health care.
Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield National Labor Office, empowering working Americans with stable health coverage for over 50 years. The National Labor Office is committed to remaining the top choice for the 17 million union workers, retirees, and families they serve. Online at bcbs.com/NLO.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The geopolitical chess match in the Asian Pacific continues to get more complicated. Last week, President Trump garnered strong media criticism by extending a White House invitation to the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, who is associated with human rights abuses happening during his rule. Duterte later replied that he was too busy to come to Washington. Today, Duterte and Chinese President Xi Jinping had a phone conversation about North Korea and other regional matters. While Duterte has spoken about his country reducing some military and economic ties to the U.S., earlier this week, he welcomed the Chinese Navy's first visit to his country in several years. A key political element in play are some disputed South China Sea's islands west of the Philippines that China claims and has built naval facilities on. Both Presidents Obama and Trump have voiced concern about China's use of these islands, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has mentioned the possibility of U.S. military action there.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. Former political detainee dies of health complications. Meanwhile, a Palestinian civilian injured by Israeli troops invading West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A former Palestinian political prisoner who joined the supporters of hunger-striking detainees at a solidarity tent died on Tuesday of a heart attack just 5 months after his release from prison. While in Israeli army detention, Mazen al-Mughrabi, 45, was subjected to medical neglect, leading to severe deterioration of his health, including kidney failure. The head of the detainee committee, Isa Karaka, stated that al-Mughrabi suffered from a heart attack and was rushed to Ramallah General Hospital, where he was pronounced dead around at dawn. The deceased was from Abawin village north of Ramallah in the central part of the occupied West Bank. The Protestant where al-Mughrabi suffered a heart attack was established to maintain a constant presence in solidarity with the hundreds of hunger-striking Palestinian political prisoners held by Israel. There are more than 1,500 Palestinians currently on hunger strike, and the number is increasing daily. The political prisoners are calling for a number of demands to be met, including medical treatment for prisoners, allowing visits from their families, and ending the so-called administrative detention in which Palestinians are held without charges for extended periods of months and years. In other news, a Palestinian civilian was injured. Many others suffered the severe effects of tear gas inhalation on Tuesday evening as Israeli troops invaded Kasra village in Yarnablus in northern West Bank. Local sources said that Israeli troops invaded the village and searched homes, which led to clashes between the invading forces and local youth who hurled stones at soldiers. Troops responded by firing tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. One civilian was injured in the leg by a rubber-coated steel bullet, medical sources reported. On Tuesday at dawn, a homemade explosive was hurled at an Israeli military jeep near Qalqilia city in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, causing damage but no injuries. The Israeli army said that several shots were also fired at the military jeep after the explosive object was thrown at it near the annexation wall close to Qalqilia city. The army added that the soldiers fired many live rounds at the area where the explosive was thrown from, while one Palestinian fired back and fled to Qalqilia. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Journalist Barrett Brown was released from prison today after an abrupt arrest last Thursday. Brown is known for his reporting and hacking of intelligence contracting firm Stratfor, revealing their methods of spying on activists on behalf of corporations. He was arrested in 2012 and spent 4 years in prison, where he wrote a prison column for The Intercept. He's given interviews since his initial release, with a PBS interview scheduled this Friday after his recent, or the Friday after his recent arrest. He was arrested during a check-in. He and his lawyer believe that the arrest came from unfiled media restriction paperwork for the Bureau of Prisons, though the concrete reason for the arrest is still unknown.
World Press Freedom Day, or World Press Day, was founded on May 3rd in 1993 in response to a call by African journalists in the Namibian capital, who in 1991 produced the Windhoek Declaration on Media Pluralism and Independence. The declaration was an instrumental statement on the principles of press freedom. It influenced the United Nations to promote the importance of reminding governments of their duty to respect and uphold the right to freedom of expression, protected under Article 19 of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Principles of the Windhoek Declaration support the freedom of communication and expression through a multitude of platforms without government censure or interference from overreaching states in lands where free press exists. Under the Windhoek Declaration, governments can decide what is public and what is classified, but they cannot fully restrict access to information. The Windhoek also states that these principles can be defended by law. There are over 100 celebrations and conferences today worldwide for Free Press Day to recognize the right of being able to express oneself and to honor the countless journalists who have lost their lives delivering information to the public. Celebrations finish with the conferring of the UNESCO Guillermo Cano World Press Freedom Prize, named for the Colombian journalist who was assassinated in front of his newspaper, the El Espectador, in Bogotá on December 17, 1986. The award is given by jury to an individual, organization, or institution that has defended free press through dangerous circumstances. According to Reporters Without Borders, there are 196 countries in the world, and 180 of them have free press. Based on their scoring system, Norway is first in freedom of the press, followed by Sweden and then Finland. America is number 43 on the list, due in part to Obama's weak policy on press support, waging war on whistleblowers, and allowing the arrest and prosecution of journalists. It was a legacy that, according to the organization, has strengthened President Trump's agenda to control free media. The 44th country on the Reporters Without Borders list is Tunisia, with number 45 going to the United Arab Emirates.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you'd like to be a part of the KBOO News team, call or stop by the station. We would love to have you here with us. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Ricky King, Ray Bodwell, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Kyle Carrezzi. Our engineer tonight is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Talia Field about her compelling new tale of marital discord, Experimental Animals. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk offers their list of summer reading favorites for your consideration. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.